Hello and welcome to the Monocle Arts Review with me, Matt Alagaya. On the programme today, we're hoping to give you some food for thought through our guests' literary and podcast picks. Those guests are Ted Hodgkinson, Senior Programmer for Literature and Spoken Word at the Southbank Centre, and Fiona Sturgis, critic for The Guardian. Elsewhere on the programme, we'll learn about the Italian music festival that inspired the Eurovision Song Contest, and Fernando, of course, will be back with this week's Global Countdown. Ted and Fiona, welcome to the show. Looking ahead to things we can read in March, let's kick things off with your literary picks, Ted. Starting with The Book of Chocolate Saints by Jeet Tyal. Outline the story told in this novel for us.
So this is a compendious novel that's part cultural history, part novel, part memoir. It tells the story of the Bombay poets in the 1970s and 1980s. This is a literary scene that the author, Jeet Tyal, who was shortlisted for the Booker Prize for his previous novel, Narcopolis, he was part of this group, although he was the younger generation of that group. And what he does is he unpicks the mythologies around these characters, the swirling rumours, the intrigues, the bad behaviour, but also it charts the sense of poetry as prophecy, of poetry as something that can be transcendent, and the title hints at the fact that these figures are saintly in some sense. And what he does is he shows us their prophetic qualities, and then he shows us their very human sides, some of their misogyny, the challenges that they faced in terms of the way that their work was received, the racism that was embedded in cultures that that fettered them and received them. So it's a really fantastic and detailed account of this really lively literary moment. It recalls in many ways The Savage Detectives by Roberto Bolaño, but I think there's something very distinctive going on here, and what he does most successfully, I think, is blur the line between fiction and fact so that you feel very much as though you're immersed in a real lived reality, and there isn't that sense of slightly sort of obvious distinction that's made sometimes in Bolaño.
And we're making our main character here is Francis Newton Xavier. I guess a lot of books have talked about the writer, talked about the artist through one person. How does this book do that differently? I mean, what's unique about his character?
Well, so firstly, in terms of the structure, it's written in this sort of polyphonic style. So you get this multi-perspective sections where you have from his old professor at university, you get it from his girlfriends.
That's very like The Savage Detectives as well.
It's very like Savage Detectives. And and it's slightly reminding me of A Brief History of Seven Killings, where you've got this kind of virtuosic switching between voices. And Jeet Tyal is a masterful prose writer, really, really precise. So he's able to do that within a sort of microtone very well. But so that structure of lots of different fragments and perspectives then gives way to these third-person sections where you get more about the specific life of this poet, who is a kind of composite figure. He's built out of several poets and painters, really. So what that does is it really kind of avoids the hagiographic style of writing about a great poet. So you can't... It's not just praise of this great poet. You get all of the sort of warts and all picture. You get the disgruntlement, the sort of the trail of destruction in a way that he leaves behind him. And so it's a sort of totally 360 degree portrait of this poet.
And it starts in New York, but then Francis takes a journey back to his home country, India. What effect does that journey have on Francis? I mean, who is he before and who is he when he gets to India?
It's an interesting question. I mean, I think one of the things that I mentioned, the reception, that sort of like racism that they face, in some ways he adopts some of the characteristics of the West, and there are parallels made in the book to V.S. Naipaul, debatable ones, but you know that he becomes a kind of a part of the literary establishment. There's a professor who links him with Ted Hughes and says that, like Hughes, he was part of this prophetic tradition who saw poetry as something that, as I say, is really about a kind of transcendent truth-telling. So he adopted some of that. But at the same time, I think what one of the things this book does is it shines a light on the very distinctively Indian scene and characteristics going on in the book. And I think there are portraits of poets who more uneasily write in both languages or straddle those cultures more uneasily. It captures this moment of extraordinary energy and vitality in Indian poetry, and also how that then ripples out and the way that that is both a challenge for the writers themselves, but also something that's a slightly forgotten moment of kind of supernovaing of talent that is something to be celebrated as well.
It's interesting. One of the characters, a professor in the book, asks, why don't we know more about this generation? Why haven't there been lots of books written about this generation of poets in India? And just finally, Francis as a character, is he a sympathetic character? I mean, do we like him, or are we kind of, because he's warts and all, do we kind of have a mixed view of him?
I did warm to him. I mean, I think there's no denying the fact that he is a flawed character. I think you see him as a tragic figure in a sense, but I think one of the things that he's really good at skewering detail in this book is his misogyny, and the way in which he, you know, there are female characters in this book, but they are pushed aside a bit by the male characters, and that is a big blind spot that he has. And I think that similarly, he's also very attuned to the disparities of class and caste as well, and that the two kind of central figures in the book who are sort of duking it out from slightly different class backgrounds as well. So you do see Francis, in a sense, he's the sort of the higher class character, comes from a sort of a more privileged background. And so his perhaps you could say his entitlement is something that the author is very keen to kind of pick under. And the character, the sort of narrator of one of the main narrators, Dismas, bears a striking resemblance to Jeet Tail as well. And there's descriptions of him which are very tongue-in-cheek and funny, describing himself as skeletal and possibly on something. But taking it all in, this kind of lidless eye that's just receiving the world around him and quietly cataloguing it.
The Book of Chocolate Saints is out on March the 1st, published by Faber. Our next book is a collection of short stories by the writer Chris Power. It's called Mothers and tells tales of people at crossroads in their lives. Ted, first of all, let's talk a bit about Chris Power. He's a journalist and writes about short stories a lot for the likes of The Guardian and The New Statesman, but now he's kind of releasing his very first collection. What's his interest in this medium?
Well, as you mentioned, he's written for The Guardian for many years, and his series, A Brief Survey of the Short Story, which you could say is sort of incorrectly named because he's been running it since 2007, and it's incredibly rich and deep. He's a critic who really knows his onions when it comes to short stories. You know, he has dismantled them and put them back together again, and he's done that across the full kind of spectrum of literature, really. He's someone who really knows the form inside out. And what's remarkable about this debut is that for somebody who has such a fine critical eye for short stories, there's a great sense of wildness to this collection. There's a sense of the unexpected. There's not a hint of formulaic or anything that feels as though it is just deploying the tactics of what he's learned through his criticism.
Which is a danger, isn't it? When a critic moves from criticism to writing themselves kind of more creatively, they often do it by numbers almost.
Yeah, I mean, there are certainly these stories are really tightly coiled and finely crafted, but I think that they do have this natural propulsion to them and a voice which is very distinctive. It's very spare, it's very pared back and controlled. But what he's able to do in the space of just a few thousand words is create these senses of characters who are in moments of change, but you can never quite pinpoint when this moment comes. And one of the kind of tried and tested cliches about short stories, the Chekhovian thing of the epiphany, that never... You know, that never comes in a sort of obvious way. They're moments of... He's capturing a kind of a sea change in their lives often. And one of the qualities of the book is that the prose has this kind of lacerating sadness to it. It really gets under the skin of a character in a moment of tumult, change, freefall. But it's often also inflected with this wry humour to it. Just to talk specifically about a couple of the stories,
please, there's
there are characters who, there's a repeating character called Eva who we meet at different points in her life, and in a sense it's the sort of seven ages of Eva, if you like. We learn about her childhood, and we hear about the kind of awkward and strange growing pains of her life in that moment, and then we chart her marriage and location of herself from that relationship, so that her narrative runs through the whole book, and then that's interspersed with, we have stories of Above the Wedding, which is one of my favourite stories, about a character who has a sort of closet affair with a man, a male character has a closet affair with a man, and then ends up at his wedding in Mexico and is quite literally rending his garments by the end of the wedding, and is in a total freefall. It's a book that isn't afraid to show you that kind of drama, but it does it with great precision and poise, and it never tips over for me into melodrama.
The character of Eva is, you've mentioned that we kind of come back to her, and it's the only story we return to here, and we have this kind of triptych of her life. Do you think the key to the rest of the stories is in her story, in a way? I mean, why do we come back to her more often than the others?
Well, I think it's partly to do with what we inherit from our mothers and what we take forward into a relationship. That she starts the book as a child and ends it as a mother, and I think it's sort of charting the damage really that is done, but also the attempt to turn that to right that balance. And I think that's a very universal question. It goes back to Greek myth of what we inherit from our parents and how we then pass that on. And I think he is chronicling that kind of inner development of her and showing us. I mean, there are lots of different stories that similarly deal with that kind of inheritance and what we owe each other really in love, what we owe each other in family, and the burden that places on us, but also that the sort of anchoring that gives to a life, you know. And I think that there's also that what Eva shows us, particularly in the first story that we see her in, is that sense of magic and expansion or expansiveness in childhood, and how that then is squared with the realities of becoming an adult.
And Power takes us on this kind of worldwide journey. We cross lots of borders, lots of cultures. We go from Exmoor to Mexico via Greece, Sweden, Austria, and many places in between. It's quite a bold ambition. Do you think he's trying to say basically that this is completely universal, these moments in our lives when we are at a crossroads? Do you think that's he's trying to say that this doesn't take heed of cultures or ages or whatever?
It's interesting. I mean, I read it that in a way a lot of the characters, a bit like Chris Power himself, have kind of dual heritage in terms of their origins, and I think that it's partly kind of where we all live these days, that we have connections to countries where we live, and we might have more than one homeland. So I think that there's something going on there. But I think the other point is that, in a sense, that despite this internationalism of our lives these days, there are certain relationships that catch up with us wherever we are. And what happens with Eva is that, especially in that middle section, she's a total globetrotter. You know, she's everywhere. And despite this, she cannot sort of outrun where she's come from. So I think that is part of the feeling of enclosure. What Power does is he shows us that the setting can be as expansive as you want. It's really about what happens in the kind of arc of a human life and how that collides with another one. And it is a really exciting arrival of, I think, a really serious talent who I think can be placed in the company of other really great short story writers. So I think it's an exciting time.
Mothers by Chris Power is out on the 1st of March and is published by Faber. And if you want to hear Chris talking about his book and short stories in general, then listen back to episode 327 of Culture with Robert Bound. Thanks, Ted, for taking us through your books today. Now let's move on to things to listen to this month. Fiona, let's talk podcasts, starting with The Walk. This aims to marry audio and exercise through immersive storytelling. What's the premise of the story?
It does, and I should just point out that I'm not a big fan of exercise.
Right.
So maybe I was sort of tipped against this from the start. But the idea is that you are taken on a walk. The narrative, such as it is, puts you at the centre of the story. So you are exercising, but really you should be concentrating on what you can hear. And the story goes that you are sitting in a train station in Scotland, and somebody, a stranger, comes up to you and hands you a package. What we're not sure about is whether you're expecting that package or whether this is a case of mistaken identity, and that becomes a little clearer as the story unfolds. And this stranger tells you that this package needs to go to, you're in Inverness, and it needs to go to Edinburgh very, very fast. It's a matter of not just life and death, it's related to the end of the world as we know it. If that sounds a bit dramatic, that is a running theme in this podcast. From that point on, you have your task, but just before you can embark on your task, and I don't think this is a spoiler because it happens so early on, there's an explosion. And that your new companion tells you that this explosion is sort of an electromagnetic pulse which takes out all technology, really. So you can't use phones, anything that uses electricity is gone. And you're also you're trying to avoid a terrorist group who we assume set off this explosion called the Burn. And they are after you and the package that you are supposed to be conveying to Edinburgh. And so your task at that point is to walk this package to Edinburgh from Inverness, which is quite a walk in itself.
Yeah, right.
And I would add that this drama is going up. I think it's weekly at the moment, and it's not over. So I don't know where it's going to go. It's about, seven or eight episodes in at the moment. And so you embark on this odyssey where you kind of pick up stragglers, you meet other people you're not sure whether they're out to get you or whether they're your allies. The stranger who passed you the package sort of melts away, but you are given an earpiece. Obviously not in real life you're not given an earpiece, but you're hearing a voice inside your head, and this voice is called Charlie, and Charlie is giving you instructions. Is anybody still with me? Because it is quite difficult to wrap your head around. And it doesn't really work, I have to say.
So the idea is that it's supposed to get you out walking and doing 2 hours walking a day or something.
Well, I think that's sort of the idea, but I think the main thing is that you get involved in a thriller, really.
Right,
you
okay.
are at the centre of a thriller. I don't think the exercise part of it is I may be wrong, but is the prime concern here. That is sort of the idea. Wouldn't it be good if you were to take a walk and you listen to a podcast called, hey, The Walk,
right.
And maybe it's going to make you walk a bit more briskly, but you're not, I don't think sort of those looking for a cardiovascular workout are going to go, I know I'm going to go for this podcast, because I think that the creators of it are more interested in storytelling. Now, the writer of The Walk is Naomi Alderman, who is a games designer but also a novelist. I think, Ted, you know a little bit about the work that she's done. But she wrote a book called The Power, which won the Bailey's Women's Prize last year. So she has massively great credentials, which is why I'm rather disappointed by it, because I was expecting something nuanced, something powerful, something that really would, you know, raise the pulse, not because you're exercising, but because it's a great story.
We've got a clip, so let's hear a short clip of The Walk.
Please. You gotta let us out. She doesn't want to say. She's too afraid to tell anyone, but we got 3 kids up in the mountains. Connor, Peter, and little Jordan. Jordan's only 2 years old. We got stuck in this town when we came to look for medicine. Jordan's real sick. Been coughing and coughing, and it just won't stop. None of the cars are working. We hope we might find a doctor, but no one's here.
That was a clip from The Walk there. The Walk is a Panoply podcast and is released every Tuesday and Thursday. Next up, we have another true crime podcast, Fiona. It's called The Atlanta Monster. Tell us a bit about the historical case that this podcast revisits.
I like the way you just said another true crime, because my eyes do roll slightly into the back of my head when I'm told launching a new true crime podcast. Do we really need any more of those? First and foremost, we don't need any more, but this one really, really does the job. It refers to a spate of killings in the late 70s and early 80s. I think they spanned roughly 1979 to 1981 in Atlanta, where we assume there was a serial killer killing children, black children specifically. So there, by the end of 1981, around 30 children had been killed, and they'd been found in sort of different states. I don't want to get too into the detail because it's nasty, but there were some that had been dumped in the river, some that had been left in woodland, some in abandoned buildings. And The media, the local media, and certainly the national media, was very, very slow to report on this. And when you think about why, well, it comes down to it being a race thing. So what is interesting and heartrending about this podcast is actually that it's not just a whodunit, it's not just your basic true crime podcast. It's a really, really evocative, thorough and desperately sad investigation into racial tension in the late 70s and class tension, and how the social and political divide meant that not only did the white community, I was going to say they didn't really care too much about these deaths, but actually they didn't hear about them for a long time. And yet the black community was absolutely, you know, living in terror. The various parts of Atlanta were on curfew. There were some of the news stations would put out, after a while, after the media started to cotton onto this, news stations would start to put out these reports at the beginning of their sort of hourly news program, saying, do you know where your children are? It's 10 o'clock. Do you know where your child is? Which now just makes your heart stop, doesn't it? You don't hear that now, because if there is a spate of murders, you tend to, it's reported from the beginning, you know, that the media is much more on it. So it's a podcast that's presented by a guy called Payne Lindsay, who is a documentary maker. But what is also good about this is he mostly stays out of it. And no disrespect to Payne Lindsay, but he will introduce the various speakers. He will reflect a little bit, but mostly he allows their sources to do the talking. And they've got an incredible array of people who, from the families of the dead children to news reporters at the time, to just Atlanta residents who just remember the atmosphere in the black community at that time. And it's really, really well put together. I would add that, like The Walk, it isn't over yet. We're roughly, again, I can't quite remember which episode we're on, but somewhere around episode 6 or 7. And so it's still unfolding. And as I understand it, the reporting is still being done. They're asking for tips from listeners. So a bit like Serial, I don't think that those making the podcast fully know where it's going to go yet.
And we also have a clip of this one. So let's hear a clip of the Atlanta Monster now.
He called me and he asked me, have you seen Patrick? What do you mean, have I seen Patrick? He's in Atlanta and I'm in Camp Lejeune, North Carolina, and he's 11 years old. I think he was just reaching for straws, because now all of a sudden he's worried. Well, you know, Patrick thinks a lot of you, and it is a possibility. Maybe got a ticket, caught the bus, and went up there to see. I says, no, Dad, I don't think that would have happened. That's kind of odd for you to say that Patrick, young as he is, would have tried to find me in North Carolina, had never been there before to the base at all. I was trying to locate me.
Talk us through, Fiona, I guess, what this series reveals about race relations in Atlanta in the late 1970s, early 80s. I mean, you said that the story is still ongoing, but presumably by episode 6 or 7, you've got a fairly good idea of, you know, they've created quite a good picture of this time.
Yes, actually, the context comes in those first couple of episodes. And it does, you know, paint a very detailed picture of what life was like for the black community, where relations were with the white community at the time. And it was bubbling under, you know, the surface tension was there, but it hadn't exploded at all. It's very much at the tail end of the civil rights movement. And I think there was a feeling in the white community, possibly, that everything's sorted. We're all OK. Everything's cool. And really, this case, by the fact that, first of all, it was so poorly reported to begin with, and the way the police approached it, which I'll come to, suggested, well, you know, the white community may think that everything's cool and all the problems are behind them, but the black community, it was a totally different thing. You know, they still felt very on the outside looking in. Obviously, you know, they made up the poorest part of the city, and the authorities were mainly white. The great coup for this podcast, I think, for Payne Lindsay, who made the podcast, is he's finally scored an interview with Wayne Williams from jail. And again, there are similarities to Serial here, where Sarah Koenig managed to talk to Adnan Syed at various stages. Wayne Williams is a very different personality, and he seems like a manic kind of man, but very, very concerned, not only for his own circumstances, but for the fact that there are lots and lots of families who still don't know what happened to their children. And it seems to be within the black community, the percentage, I think, thrown out, and I can't remember who said this, was about around 90% of the black community think that he didn't do it, whereas a much smaller percentage of the white community think that he did do it, and therefore it's all done, we don't need to bother ourselves with this. There are hints at various stages, and it's still coming together, that of white paedophile rings, of involvement of the Klan, but that has yet to be fully explored.
Atlanta Monster is produced by Tenderfoot TV and How Stuff Works and is available to listen now. Thanks very much, Fiona. Now, you might be a fan of Eurovision, but have you ever heard of the competition that inspired it? Sanremo is a music festival that's held every year by Italy's national broadcaster on the Mediterranean coast. For almost 70 years, it has played host to Italian musicians performing unreleased music and is just wrapping up its 2018 edition. To tell us more about its significance in Italy, Fernando Augusto Pacheco spoke to Monocle writer and our own resident Italian, Chiara Ramella.
It's a festival that's in its 68th edition now, so very much part of our history. And that represents a moment where all of the glories of the, from the point of view of the presenters and the comedians, the actors, everyone who's part of pop culture just congregates in Sanremo and gets wheeled out onto the stage. And what's really interesting about it is that even though it doesn't really necessarily bear any particular relevance in terms of the contemporary discourse or the contemporary music scene or film scene for that matter, all of these old glories just are so appreciated by the public that it's just such a joy to see the display every single year. What's also most interesting is that it's such a marathon every year. You know, it's
live on TV, I presume.
Yes, and it starts on a Tuesday, ends on a Saturday, goes on until the early hours of the morning. So you, in order to watch it, you really have to commit. And I think another thing that's astonishing is that there are 20 songs from the big kind of champions section of the festival, which are battling each other. And then there are 8 from the up-and-coming section of the festival. Now, you would expect they play once and then they eliminate some and then eventually we get to the winner. But no, no, no. This is not how the festival works. So on the first evening, you get the 20 bigs to perform their song once. Very good. Second evening, you get to hear 10 of the bigs to perform their songs again, plus half of the emerging artists. The third evening, you get the second half of the bigs replaying their own songs, plus the second half of the emerging artists. Fourth evening, you get all of the big artists to play them all over again, but in a duet with somebody else completely unrelated to the first version of the song. And then finally, on the fifth and final evening, you're listening to the whole set of songs just one more time again, because who cares? If we can, we must.
I love the complex rules. I can see now why the Eurovision Song Contest was inspired by the Sanremo, with all this kind of complex rules. I mean, who will play where and when.
Absolutely.
I mean, let's look historically. I mean, it did inspire, you know, what's arguably the biggest, you know, festival in Europe, which is the Eurovision.
So, absolutely.
So tell us a bit about the history. I mean, it's been going on for about 70 years.
Yes, indeed. So the first edition was in 1953. And actually, at the very beginning, Sanremo wasn't that big a deal mediatically. And it wasn't until 1958 that it became popular across the country, when Domenico Modugno won with his Nel Blu Dipinto di Blu, a song that most people abroad will probably know as Volare. And then since then, it just became this moment, this crucial moment in the popular culture of Italy. In the 60s, there were so many controversies because suddenly you had artists who were a little bit more rebellious, bringing rebellious songs to a stage which is very much kind of aimed at the families and the you know, the cross strata of Italian society. In the 70s, it was quite criticised because all the artists that kept going on stage in the 70s were quite anachronistically still the 60s artists. So there's always been this bit of a vintage edge to Sanremo. Even in the 70s, it was already vintage. But then actually towards the end of the 80s and the mid-90s, it became a place where really some of the emerging artists of Italy that have gone on to become some of the most loved people in Italian music were discovered. People like Giorgia, Eros Ramazzotti, Zucchero, they all came out of Sanremo, or at least their big first hit was a Sanremo winner. Like, you think about Giorgia and Come Saprei, which is an absolute belter of a song, which won 1995 edition. That's how she came about, and she's now still a staple of Italian music.
Well, Chiara, we have a little surprise here. We prepared a medley with some of the most iconic songs from the festival. Let's listen to it.
Penso che un sogno così non ritorni mai più.
Nessuno mi può giudicare, nemmeno tu.
L'Americale fa male, lo so.
Lo so. Poi ci troveremo come l'estate a bere del whisky a prossima.
Bringing all the emotions, right, Chiara? I can see you dancing here in studio.
I can't help it. There's something quite so nostalgic about Sanremo as a whole, I think, for an Italian. Even if you hate it, even if you know that it's not really that cool, we all watch it, we all follow it, we all need to know.
Well, let's talk about 2018, this year's festival. Who do you think we should watch out for? Of course, I believe the big final is tomorrow, Saturday. Tell us about your picks.
Well, I think my picks don't necessarily correspond to the favourites for the festival, because we've got to remember that, for example, last year, a song like Occidentalis Karma, which obviously went on to Eurovision, was very popular. And I think there's this bit of a tendency at the moment in Italian pop to go the social criticism / satire route. And there are obviously a few songs of that kind on this edition of Sanremo as well. And they're slated for doing really well. One of them is Una Vita in Vacanza by Lo Stato Sociale. Again, kind of a bit of a young band that's presenting themselves as kind of critical of the fashion bloggers online and the rest of it. So a bit of a social criticism there. Other than that, another bit of a favourite is Diodato with Roy Paci with Adesso. It's one of those rousing songs that's built around the crescendo of drums. So predictable, so incredibly predictable. It works, obviously, because that pattern always works. So it's probably going to do quite well. But I would like to think that someone like Annalisa is going to do well this year. I hope for her. This is her fourth time at Sanremo. The first time she was ninth, the second time she was fifth. Last time she was 11th, and I really hope this is the year for her, because I think her song is catchy. Although on the Italian media, it's been described as a British ballad. So I wonder if maybe I'm looking at it with the eyes of the international audience. But I think it's quite catchy. Shall we have a listen?
I liked your pick, Chiara, I have to say. I disagree with it.
I thought it would resonate with you.
Well, talking about that, I see your mum is also a big fan. I mean, I know you've been talking to her to do some research about Sanremo. I mean, we should be watching there in Italy.
Well, of course, everybody does. Even if you don't think you will, you can't help it. I mean, purely for the fact that it's on for something like 4 or 5 hours on a block on evening telly for pretty much a week, you can't escape it. I'd like to do like one mention, though, of one song that I think we truly need to be listening to this edition. It's part of the up-and-coming section, and it's called Il Congiuntivo by Lorenzo Baglioni. And the reason why I'm saying this is because it's such a hilarious song. It's based on the idea that Italians often struggle to conjugate verbs properly in kind of hypothetical clauses. It's very difficult, and many people can't do it properly, and it's considered a bit uncouth not to be able to do it. So this guy, who's a former teacher of maths at school, has created an entire song about teaching people how to do things properly. And the lyrics go, the conjunctive has a distinctive role. It is used for events that are not real. It is relative to what's subjective, unlike other verbal modes.
Thanks very much to Chiara. And Fernando is in the studio now with us for this week's Global Countdown. Faye, you're a bit of a Eurovision fan. Do you think you'll be going to San Remo next year?
I would love that. And you know the song Volare, the very famous Italian song, actually was discovered in San Remo. So it still has a very strong tradition there in Italy. And yeah, Chiara gave us some tips as well for this year's San Remo, what to expect.
Excellent. Okay. Where are we heading now for the Global Countdown?
Let's head to Norway. I think it's a very interesting top five this week. And a very controversial number one, I have to say. I don't know if that would be allowed in some countries, but I give you this snippet. But shall we start with number five?
Sure, yeah.
First of all, we have a clip, and I want you guys to tell me which song does it remind you. It's Ina Rodsen with Strongest. Well, I think that's very similar to Shape of You by Ed Sheeran in a way. It's almost the same
yes.
beat. Yeah.
Yes, now you mention it. Although I had a mental picture of Shakira and her undulating hips.
Could be a mixture of Ed Sheeran with Shakira, you know?
I had a bit of Britney going on as well.
And Britney
stronger.
As well.
Yeah.
What a weird hybrid person.
Yeah. Great, I have to say, it's a cool song. I mean, it's a shame that I thought it was perhaps a bit too similar. But she's a Norwegian singer. She's been doing very well in her own country. She was in a duo called Ask Ambia. It's a very popular electropop band from there. And I believe she's based in London as well. So it's an interesting... And, you know, I love charts that have a lot of local artists in the top five. And I think we see that in the Norwegian chart as well. Number four, I think it's quite cool. And actually, it features Miley Cyrus' sister. But it's not only that. It's a Norwegian DJ, Alan Walker, with Noah Cyrus and an English DJ called Digital Farm Animals. Shall we hear It All Falls Down? 'Cause when it all very easy in the year, don't you think?
Yeah, it's very Norwegian.
Very Norwegian, yeah. And do you know how old is Alan Walker, actually? He's 20 now. And he became like a massive pop star in 2015 with a song called Faded. So he was only 18, so he's very, you know, premature. Very, very good. It's an easy song. It's a good one.
There's a sisterly twang to the voice as well. You can detect a similarity, can't you? It's... the Cyrus sisters, I mean, you know.
Exactly. And I think she's doing well, Noah Cyrus. Not as much as her sister, but, you know, she's all right. number three, I mean, I have to say, it's the same band that is number one. Oh, my God, I'm revealing everything already. But it's not a very controversial song. So basically, in Norway, it's happening, especially in the world of hip-hop, it's happening what's happening in the US, in the UK, where there's a lot of collaborative songs. So basically, there's like five rappers singing one song. And this time, they decided to create a band called Mars. So the three top Norwegian hip-hop artists, which is Carpe Diem, Unge Ferrari, and Arif, they released an EP, you know, with their band called Mars, and it's doing so well in the Norwegian charts, even in the whole top 20. You can see more of their tracks as well. And this is one of them. It's called Jeg Leimeg, sorry for my Norwegian, which means I am sorry. And it's a good hip-hop song. Let's hear it. Ikke si sånn, lei seg med Nelly. Eller Tristan, dansen, back, please. Heisan. Men jo mor er jom som Jonas Benjobb, jeg på lopp med dommer med unge og salom. Jeg leimer, hvis jeg ikke får deg, vil jeg. Interesting, and they do mention Liza Minnelli.
She gets a name check early on.
I should have done a better research. I don't know why they mention Liza Minnelli, but it is an interesting name to drop in a song, I would say. And guys, may I say as well, Norway has a very strong history of hip-hop as well. They had a band called Madcon, which I think we even play here in Monaco 24. They became popular in other countries as well, in other charts. So they do have a little tradition there. Yeah. But I think Mars, if you want to be in tune what's happening in the world of Norwegian hip-hop,
that's this is the super group.
Exactly. A little tip for you.
They also have a Sami rap scene, a little one, right? There's Slin Craze. There's a Sami rapper up in the north of Norway who raps only in Sami, and it's becoming, he's, you know, getting greater recognition around the world, which is kind of incredible. Indigenous people, I think there's only like 20,000 Sami speakers.
Wow.
And he's you know, he's really popular in Norway now, which is exciting.
Thanks for the idea for a future package here for Monaco 24 on the Arts Review. I think it's a good one. Shame they're not here in the top five. Number two, you have we have a short clip. It's Eminem and Ed Sheeran again. This time it's himself with the song River.
Get on my soapbox and preach my sermon and speech detergent and bleach is burning the wound. Cause now with her in the womb, we can't bring her in this world to the new. To use protection for our pitted to your forbidden fruit.
I've been a liar, been a thief, been a lover, been a cheat. Oh, my sins need holy water, feel it washing over me.
You know, I am not a big fan, but I understand they're very popular, number two in Norway. Number one, let's hear a clip first, and then I'll tell you why it's so controversial. I'm not easily shocked, but I was a bit shocked, I have to say. Let's listen to it. So here you go, that's Mars again with their most popular song. I think the beat is fantastic. I can totally understand why it's number one. But then I saw the title of the song, of course, my Norwegian, well, was non-existent. It's called Jeg bruker ikke kondom. And actually, when you translate that, I do not use kondom. That's the title of the song. And then I was like, oh my God, that's, you know, for being the title of the song. And then I did some little Googling there, and I think the Norwegian tabloids are reporting that, you know, some sexologists were giving interviews saying that they're worried that young people will not use condom anymore. So it's creating a little bit of a...
It's not a great message, is it?
It's not a great message, but apparently when you read the lyrics, they tell what's happening as well, because you don't wear a condom, apparently, you know, people get pregnant. So they do mention that in the song, but still...
It's in the small print.
Yeah, it's in the small print.
T's and C's.
And with this kind of electro beat, I think you almost forget, especially for an international listener who don't know. I was singing to it and I had no idea. But that's why it's good to do some research.
Yeah, clearly a great marketing strategy though, isn't it? If you're going to have a title like that.
Exactly. And the tabloids in Norway, they're saying, oh, will the condom sales drop? You know, they did. There's so many stories.
Oh my goodness. It's
an interesting story, but I'm quite shocked. It's a good song though. That's a shame.
Now to work on a Norwegian tabloid. That brings us to the end of today's programme. Thanks very much to my guests, Ted Hodgkinson and Fiona Sturgis. The show was produced by Holly Fisher and I'm Matt Allagaier. We'll be back at the same time next week, but for now, let's play out some more of that questionable Norwegian number one. Thanks for listening. Goodbye. Yeah.